Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and we're in the muscle chapter, and today is April 14th. Let's take a look at the schedule and see where we are. Okay, so far all the lectures are online to listen to again. The 14th of April, right here. We're supposed to be in muscle physiology. All right, we're a little bit, is that right? Spring 2015, April 14th, muscle physiology 2. So we're right on schedule. Well, I thought we were a week behind. We're not a week behind. That is really nice. All right, so what is a week from today? 21st. No exam schedule, but we're going to have a lecture on blood, heart, and circulation, the second lecture on that. And then a week and a half from today is your third exam on chapters 10, 11, 12, and 13. So we got to get through this information. Okay, as far as the circulatory system is concerned, like the structure of the heart and all of that, that's a prerequisite for this class. So make sure you know all those things that you learned in anatomy about the heart, because we got to move through that and talk about physiology. So, for instance, I think I just asked you this not too long ago. How many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? Okay, if you have paused to think of any of that, then that's terrible, because there's four chambers, there's four valves, right? And then you just got to fill in the pieces. So you got to just get that on the tip of your tongue. All right, so does anybody have any questions on muscle physiology of what we covered so far? You're all pretty good with that? All right, then let's get started. How a fiber contracts. What's another name for a fiber? Another name for a fiber. Muscle cell. What kind of muscle cell in particular? I'm thinking of. What can you tell me about a fiber, like a thread? What does it look like? It's wound together, but in terms of the dimensions. Okay, it's cylindrical and long. That's right. It's not branched, right? It's very, very long, and you could think of it as being cylindrical. And so that is what we call a fiber. A muscle fiber is long, unbranched, and it's cylindrical. Okay. All right, let me get everything working just the way we like to have it. Nice. Okay, so you learned about a sarcomere. I'm going to scoot ahead a couple. Did we talk about a sarcomere?
No, we actually didn't get here.
We didn't get here, that's right. I started too soon. Structure of a muscle fiber. That's what I want to talk about. We talked about motor units. Okay, one thing I do want to point out about a motor unit, something is a little funny the way your book talks about it. Remember, a motor unit is one motor neuron and all the individual muscle fibers that it innervates, right? So one motor neuron can cause three muscle fibers to contract, or many, hundreds or even thousands, right? And your book uses this term small and large, right? And then you look at these ratios. So if you have one divided by 100 and one divided by 2,000, which is a smaller number? 1 over 100 or 1 over 2,000? 1 over 2,000 is a lot smaller, right? But that's not what they mean. They mean just look at this number here. So what is a smaller number, 100 or 2,000? Yeah, that's what they mean, right? Not the ratio. The smaller number of muscle fibers is what this small right here is referring to, right? So fine control occurs when the motor units are small, namely this number here, not 2,000, right? So 1 to 100 is a lot smaller than 1 to 2,000. Okay, that's what they mean by that. Kind of confused me for a couple of years until I sat down and decided to figure out what they were talking about. Okay, structure of a muscle fiber. It's not branched. We all agree with that. It's multinucleate because at one time it was hundreds of muscle cells, progenitor muscle cells that fused together. The organelle for contraction within this muscle fiber is called what? Who can tell me what that's called? Okay. So here is the cell, and when I look inside the cell, I see structure. Do you see structure inside there?
Yeah,
indeed you do. And I see a particular structure here. There's another one here, another one here. And what? It's long, like a fiber as well. That is the organelle of contraction. And it is a myofibril. Right, so myofibril is the organelle for contraction. A myofibril is made up of sarcomeres that line up from end to end throughout the whole extent of the myofibril, and those sarcomeres line up with each other in neighboring myofibrils. That's why when you look at a muscle fiber or muscle tissue underneath a microscope, it looks striated, because these patterns do line up with each other perfectly. And as a matter of fact, if we look inside a myofibril, do you see structure? Yeah, I see even some more structure, right? So we're going to look at these repeated units over and over again, and we're going to have to learn something about that structure that we see inside every myofibril. So this is what that previous slide was attempting to show you. There are some filaments, myofilaments. The two myofilaments that cause contraction are myosin and actin. Myosin is the thick one, actin is the thin one. Right, and the sarcomere extends from Z-disc to Z-disc. That repeats itself over and over. So we would like to think of the material between these Z-discs as a sarcomere. So the Z-disc is the endpoint of a sarcomere, right? And so the structural and functional unit of contraction in cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle is the sarcomere, which means that if you understand how one sarcomere works, then you understand how all work in all skeletal muscle, all cardiac muscle, right? So we have to analyze this sarcomere. All right, on the thick filament, we see some of these head groups sticking off. So it's not smooth, it's kind of rough, it has these little knobs sticking out of it. The myosin is located exactly in the middle of the sarcomere, and this particular sarcomere is at rest, it's not contracted. And the H zone has some proteins that hold the myosin just in the right location. It kind of anchors the myosin within the sarcomere. The other filament, the thin filament, otherwise known as actin, is not attached to anything in the H zone, or this is actually called an M line that forms right in the, here's a nice M line forming right in the middle. The actin is attached to the Z disc. Right, and so you got actin on one side of the sarcomere, actin on the other. It's firmly attached to the Z-discs. All right, so when muscle contracts, the Z-discs are going to get closer together. Right, and that's going to, and all of the myofibril, all of these sarcomeres within a myofibril are going to shorten. All the myofibrils within a skeletal muscle cell are going to shorten. So hence, the whole muscle fiber contracts as a result of that. So fortunately, I have in my hand right here, maybe I'll turn this one little light on, like that. I have a thick filament, right, and I have a thin filament. And that makes the sarcomere up, and the sarcomere is going to shorten, it's going to contract. Which one of these proteins is actually going to shorten?
Neither.
Is it the myosin or actin?
Neither.
You guys don't even need to take this class. This is true. Neither shorten, all right? So, but these two little markers right here could actually be a really nice model of actin and myosin, right? Thick filament, thin filament. So how could you explain? How would the ends of these two markers come closer together, right, if neither of these markers shorten? Yeah, they can slide over the top of each other, right? So we call that the sliding filament mechanism, right? So the ends of these markers get closer together if they slide over each other. So we're going to look at that. So none of those proteins actually shorten. Again, you do have to know those exam figures, right, where it labels the different parts of this particular sarcomere. The A band is located wherever you see a myosin molecule, and fortunately, it looks dark, right? So, and that's not how the A band got its name, because there's an A in dark, but it works really nice to remember that. So here's the A band. That shows us where myosin is. And where you don't have myosin, you have a lighter band. So that's what we call the I band. We have some other bands in the middle, okay, like this H zone. And that's a little bit lighter because if you look at the H zone when the sarcomere is relaxed, I see myosin, but I don't see actin. So if you put actin and myosin, or if you overlap actin and myosin together, then that's a little bit darker than the H zone. But the H zone, nonetheless, is still in the A band. So how did people figure out the sliding filament mechanism? Right? Well, it was from doing electron microscopy. I don't know how many people got a Nobel Prize for figuring this out, but at least one person did. Okay, so if we look at these sarcomeres, we have one that is relaxed, and okay, this is still a relaxed condition here as well, right? And let me look at the next slide, and even the next one. How come I don't see one that is in a contracted state? Maybe that slide got deleted. Okay. It's not here. I can only describe to you what's going to happen. Dang, I wish I could show you. Okay. Well, when the actin and myosin filaments slide over each other, right, the Z-disc get closer to the myosin on this end. This Z-disc gets closer to the myosin on this end. So this band, this very light, disappears. So when a sarcomere contracts, what happens to this I band? It goes away. Right? And so if a sarcomere is contracted or muscle fiber is contracted, you would not see this light band. And also something else would disappear, and that is this H zone, because the actin would overlap myosin completely. Right? So the H zone gets smaller or disappears, and the A band gets the I band gets smaller or disappears when the sarcomere contracts. So if you look at a sarcomere in contraction, you would notice that the length of the myosin filament would be exactly the same whether the sarcomere is contracted or relaxed. The length of an actin would be the same whether that sarcomere is relaxed or contracted. And I know you have some pictures in your book that show you that. All right. Well, if we look at the end of a myofibril, okay, then we see all of the myosin filaments, right? These are the thick, and then the actin, which are these little thin dots right here. So what surrounds this myosin molecule? So we got to think in three dimensions now a little bit. All right, this one myosin myofilament is completely surrounded by actin, and every actin filament is surrounded by myosin, right? So right here is just a two-dimensional representation of a sarcomere, but in real life you have to realize that this one myosin myofilament is what? Surrounded 360 degrees with actin. And same thing for actin. It's surrounded by myosin. All right, so here is a good exam figure. The only thing that I haven't mentioned so far is this titin molecule. That's a myofilament, but it has elastic properties. So in order for you to notice that something has elastic properties, what do you have to do to it? What do you have to do to it? To observe its elastic properties. You got to stretch it out. That's right. And then if you let go, it goes back to its normal resting length. Right? So this elastic filament right here doesn't cause shortening because it can't really pull on anything. It can only restore the resting length after a muscle is stretched. Right? But it can't really cause the sarcomere to get shorter than its resting length. So this is just a passive shortening after the sarcomere is stretched, but it helps align the myosin with the actin filaments. Okay, so if you're thinking about contraction or shortening of a sarcomere, you should just think about actin and myosin and just kind of remember that this titin is there. All right, so we're going to use the sliding filament mechanism. Oh, here's the slide I was looking for. All right, so here is the Z disc. That's the end of a sarcomere. The very top row is when the muscle is relaxed. All right, so I see a nice I band, a good A band, H zone right here in the middle. When it starts to contract, how do you know that this muscle fiber here or this myofibril is contracting? Yeah, because the Z lines are closer together on the second row, right? It's closer together. All right, and then if we fully contract this myofibril, notice that the Z discs are now even closer together. And if you look at this particular micrograph, I don't see any I band whatsoever, right? And I really don't see an H zone in this area as well. So if you look at the illustration, you can see that there's very little overlap of actin and myosin when the muscle is relaxed, right? And the overlap gets more and more as the sarcomere contracts. And at this point in time, What do you think about this sarcomere? Can it contract anymore when it gets to this third condition? It can't, because the myosin is bumping up against the Z-disc, and it just can't shorten anymore. Right? But you see how the filaments just slide over each other. And that's what we call the sliding filament theory of muscle contraction. Right? Well, we want to know a little bit more about that. So we're going to have to, this is something that you didn't learn in anatomy. All right? You did learn about myosin and actin. Right? But there's some components. Let's talk about myosin first. Myosin has these side groups coming off of them, and it has a thin area right here that we call a tail, and on the top of the tail is a head group. There's nothing so special about the myosin tail, except it does interact with the head group because it can either be in this flexed condition, say a nice 90 degrees here, or it can be in an extended conformation. All right, so when it's extended, all right, then it's a little bit longer, and it's going to reach a different part of the actin molecule. The head group, a little bit more complicated. It has a site right up over here, right at the very tip, that we call the actin binding site, which means what? It can actually bind to the actin molecule, attach itself to the actin molecule. The second site it has is right here, and that is an active site that ATP can fit in. And this active site also has enzymatic activities. It can hydrolyze ATP to ADP and inorganic phosphate. But that's not the whole equation, right? If you have ATP going to ADP and inorganic phosphate, what other thing do you have to put on the product side of that chemical reaction? You got to put, what we got? ATP, maybe you can see this, ATP going to ADP. ADP plus inorganic phosphate plus, and this is what I want you to know. What's going to be right here? I'll have to give you a hint. Is this endergonic or exergonic reaction? Okay. It is exergonic. That's right. So what do I want to put in that bracket over there? Energy. That's right. Let's do that. Okay, and that energy is there to do work. And what it's going to do is change the conformation of this thing that we call a cross bridge. All right, so ATP can bind over here. And when ATP is hydrolyzed, that forces this cross bridge to go from a flexed condition to an extended form. Right, so it changes the conformation. ATP has a couple other functions that we're going to look at in just a little bit. All right, so that's the myosin. The actin above it, you can see, is made up of a bunch of globular kinds of proteins that form a nice linear chain. There's two chains, and they wrap around each other. There's some other proteins associated with the G-actins. There's a really long, thin molecule called tropomyosin, and there's another shorter molecule called troponin. And troponin is a cousin molecule to calmodulin. I can't show you pictures of those two. Okay, but you just have to trust me. Troponin is a cousin to calmodulin, and it has pretty much the same kind of function in terms of binding. Can anybody remember what binds to calmodulin? Calcium. Yeah, calcium ions, right? And it modulates the activity of some enzymes inside the cell. Well, troponin will do the same thing. It can bind to calcium. It's going to change the conformation of this tropomyosin, and that's going to allow for sliding of these myofilaments. All right, so here is a myosin, an actin on top, and now I see that the myosin head group, here's the binding site for actin, has attached itself to an actin molecule. Here is the active site, and ATP has already been hydrolyzed into ADP and inorganic phosphate. When inorganic phosphate leaves the active site, that's going to change a conformation of this cross bridge, going from an extended to a flexed condition. All right, so what happens to a weight that's in your hand when you flex your biceps or you flex your elbow? Yeah, it moves, right? So when the cross bridge flexes like this, it's going to pull an actin molecule to the right. Right, and it's going to do that, what, 360 degrees all the way around that myosin molecule, hundreds of myosin molecules in every myofibril, so that generates a lot of force, bringing all of the Z-discs together within all those sarcomeres that make up one myofibril, and hence, you know, every single muscle fiber. So this is what we call the power stroke. Right, so when the conformation changes from extended to flex, that's the power stroke. That's what's going to cause these filaments to slide over each other. And what's the trigger mechanism? Okay, the trigger mechanism that causes the change in conformation of this cross bridge from linear, okay, to bent, or from extended to flexed. It is, yeah, the release of phosphate from the active site. All right, so when phosphate leaves, that causes this conformation change and the filaments slide over each other. All right, well, we got to look a little bit more at how this works because it's a cycle. And of course, you can see a myosin molecule and an actin right here. And I guess we're going to start, we could start anywhere in this cycle. Let's try starting at number one. Okay, number one, actin and myosin are not attached to each other in this particular condition, right? ATP has already been hydrolyzed, and we have ADP and inorganic phosphate. When we're in this condition right here, it is possible for the myosin head to attach itself to the actin molecule because it's a nice extended conformation. Right, so the head group is going to attach to actin, and that's what we see right here. It's attached. After it attaches, the inorganic phosphate is released. And what does that cause? Flex. Yeah, it goes through that flex condition. When it goes from extended to flex, that's what we call a power stroke, as long as it's attached to this actin molecule. Right, after the power stroke, then the ADP can leave the active site. Notice when ADP leaves, that just leaves an empty active site right here. But what about the association between myosin and actin? What about this cross bridge? Is it still there or has it come apart? Yeah, it's still there. Okay, it has just gone through this power stroke. All right, so myosin is still attached to actin and we have this empty active site. And what can fit into this active site? An ATP molecule. All right, when ATP binds, that's what's going to cause the release of actin from this myosin. Right, so when ATP binds, it causes release. So I don't see a cross bridge, a crossover there anymore. So in order for myosin to let go of actin, what has to be present in the cell? ATP has to be in the cell. If there's no ATP, what's going to happen to the relationship between actin and myosin? They're going to get stuck together, right? They can't release from each other. All right, so then after ATP binds to the active site, all right, it's going to hydrolyze. That gives you some energy to change the conformation of this cross bridge going from a flex back to an extended condition right here because, what, it's an exorganic reaction. So now that energy is stored in this extended form of the cross bridge. And right, then once ATP is high, or once it gets into this extended position, then it's in the right position to where it can bind to actin. All right, so now we have a complete cross bridge formed. It's in an extended form. It's attached to actin. It has both ADP and inorganic phosphate in the active site. And as soon as inorganic phosphate leaves, what happens? Yeah, that stored energy, right, now is released and it causes flexion of that cross bridge, and then we're back down to over here. Right? And so when it goes from extended to flex, that causes the sliding of these filaments. We call that the power stroke. And that's due to what? Inorganic phosphate leaving the active site. All right, so this is an exam figure, I'm sure, of some kind. Okay. And just remember something strange here. In order for myosin to unlatch itself or unattach itself to actin, it has to have just binding of ATP. So if there's no ATP in this muscle cell, then this muscle cell is going to always remain contracted, right? And that's how we explain rigor mortis. Rigor mortis is a condition where muscles in a person that's died, a corpse, are contracted, even though they're not alive. Muscles start to contract because what happens when somebody dies? What about ATP concentration? It goes down, right? Because mitochondria aren't getting oxygen, it goes down, ATP goes down, and as there's no ATP, right, these cross bridges just remain attached together. Actin is attached to myosin. And there's something else, too. All right, as we run out of ATP, something happens to calcium. Where is calcium usually at a high concentration? Outside the cell, very low inside. Right? Calcium is also at a high concentration in sarcoplasmic reticulum, smooth sarcoplasmic reticulum in particular. How did all that calcium get inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum? Because it's got to go from low concentration to high? What's that? What's low concentration to high? I heard diffusion, but I would like a different answer. Okay? From low concentration. What is diffusion? Which way does diffusion go? Yeah, diffusion is from high to low. Okay, this is going the other way. Calcium is going from low to high. It's high in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. What is that? Okay, can't be any kind of diffusion, because diffusion goes from high to low. It's got to be active transport. And in particular, it's primary active transport. All right, so what happens to that transport after somebody dies and ATP starts to go away? Well, then it doesn't work, right? And so all that calcium inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum can leak out into the cytosol, and we're going to see that's been a very important signal for these cross bridges to form, right? So when somebody dies, ATP goes away, these muscles get latched up, and the reason why, because calcium floods all of these myofibrils because the ATP is no longer there to pump it into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, well, we're on our way to understanding something about calcium. All right, here is that actin molecule. Remember, it's made up of three components, these G-actins, globular subunits that are put together that form, even though they're globular subunits, they form a nice linear chain. And here is the troponin molecule. You could consider it a complex if you want, but it's probably not so important. But what is important is troponin is attached to the tropomyosin. All right, so they're two separate, you should think of them as two separate components of that actin myofilament, right, but they do touch each other. And I think that's really all you need to know about this particular slide. Because there's something really important that you can't see. Remember the head group? The head group over here, right there, let me go back one more. The head group has an actin binding site, which means that there has to be a binding site on actin for myosin, right? There's got to be a reciprocal site. So when we look at this picture right here, we don't see the myosin binding site because it's covered up. It's hidden by the tropomyosin. And if that binding site is covered by tropomyosin, cross bridges cannot form, even though there's ATP. Right? There's just no way to do that. So in order for cross bridges to form and cycle, right, this tropomyosin has to get out of the way. It has to uncover those binding sites. And the signal for that is calcium. Calcium will bind to troponin. That changes the conformation of this whole complex, and it will reveal the binding site for myosin underneath. All right, and so now you have the actin binding site on the head group. It can associate with the myosin binding site on these G-actins. I still don't see it over here. All right, but nonetheless, when calcium binds to troponin, it's going to move out of the way. This is probably a pretty good view right here. Here is the tropomyosin molecule. It's covering up these binding sites. When calcium binds to troponin, look what happens to tropomyosin. It gets out of the way. And so now the actin binding site on myosin can attach to the myosin binding site on this G-actin. And that's a result of an increase of calcium, right, within the myofibril. And where does this calcium come from? We just kind of talked about that. It comes from, could be an extracellular source because it's high outside the cell, and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right. The most important calcium for skeletal muscle is the calcium inside smooth endoplasmic reticulum, not so much from the extracellular source. All right. Well, we know a lot about tropomyosin and troponin. We know a lot about the sarcomere. We know that calcium is an important signal, right, because it moves tropomyosin out of the way and allows for the cross bridge to cycle. But how does a skeletal muscle cell know when to release calcium into the myofibril for contraction? All right, and so that's what we call excitation-contraction coupling mechanism. So we got to look at that whole process together. And in order to do that, we got to go back to anatomy just a little bit. All right, so here I see a nucleus, another one here. So what are we looking at on this figure? a muscle fiber, right, a whole muscle fiber. Here's the cell membrane. Sometimes we call that the sarcolemma. Anytime you hear that term sarco, you should think of skeletal muscle. You see some structures inside this fiber, namely the units of the organelle of contraction. Yeah, the nice myofibrils. And inside these myofibrils, you see nice myofilaments like actin and myosin that can slide over each other if there is a calcium signal. Right, and since it has mitochondria, let's pretend I see, oh, here's probably a mitochondria here and here making ATP, so there's plenty of energy available for cross-bridge cycling. All right, so how does that calcium flood this myofibril? Well, this is the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Right, it has a pretty interesting conformation to it. It has a little network, right, but on the ends, this is what we call the terminal cisternae. These are large areas of large volumes of the sarcoplasmic reticulum that contain calcium. And I see it over here. So I see this thing, this is what we call a transverse tubule, because, yeah, or T-tubule, because what kind of section, how is this fiber cut? In a longitudinal, from end to end, or maybe from top to bottom? Top to bottom, and so what do you call that? That is a nice transverse cut on this particular fiber. And these tubes right here are arranged in that same orientation, so we call these the transverse tubules. Now, what is a transverse tubule? If we follow this transverse tubule, it goes all the way up to the cell membrane. And it's just an extension of the cell membrane that goes deep inside the muscle fiber cell. All right. There'll be electrical activity on the surface of this muscle cell, and that electrical activity would not be able to get to the interior of the cell around all these myofibrils if it were not for these T-tubules, right? The T-tubules sort of act as a wire, right, to allow those electrical signals to penetrate everywhere inside of a muscle cell. So what kind of electrical activity that you know can move on the surface of a cell, okay, and it can move around on the surface of a cell changing the membrane potential?
Voltage-gated
coating. Yeah, like voltage-gated channels, right? When the permeability of a membrane changes due to voltage-gated channels, sodium and potassium, what does that produce? It's got a threshold. An action potential. That's right. So a muscle cell is a lot like an axon because it has voltage-gated channels. It can propagate action potentials, right? So what's the action potential like down at the bottom of this fiber compared to the top? The action potential is going to be the same, right? It moves without decrement. It will also move down, the action potential will also move down through the transverse tubule deep inside the cell. So what might you guess that this transverse tubule has? It's got to have voltage-gated channels of some kind, right? So what does that mean? An action potential not only flows over the whole cell surface, but it also flows into the cell because there's a T-tubule there. All right. So this combination of two terminal cisternae and in the middle a transverse tubule that's carrying this electrical information is sometimes what we call a triad. Right? The cisternae are the ends. And what's inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum? High levels of calcium ions. That's right. And that's necessary for muscle contraction. All right, so you're probably wondering, well, gee whiz, I thought calcium was important for bones. It is important for bones. But when we start to run low on calcium, maybe because we don't have it in our diet, maybe we don't have vitamin D in our diet, so we're not absorbing calcium. Your body needs calcium for muscle contraction. Where does it get it from? From your bones. And if you had a choice of putting calcium where it belongs, would you put it in bones to make bones strong so they don't break, or in skeletal muscle so that skeletal muscle can contract? Yeah, because you have to breathe, right? And calcium is an important signal for cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. Your heart would not beat either without proper levels of calcium. So you might be working in an ER sometime. Somebody might hand you a vial of blood and say, hey, we need some lights on this right away. What do you got to do? What's going on? You got to take that blood down to the lab. They got to analyze the blood for electrolytes, like calcium. Are calcium levels at a proper level? Sodium and potassium at proper levels? Because if these ions are not, then, of course, these muscles aren't going to contract. You won't have proper synaptic transmission or nerve conduction, right? So these things are really important. Okay, so here we have a nice, kind of like a sagittal section. This is where we're going to look at excitation-contraction coupling. Right, so here we have a nice somatic motor neuron coming down, synaptic vesicles. When an action potential comes down, that opens some calcium channels. It causes the fusion of these synaptic vesicles into the neuromuscular junction, right, because here is the neuron, here is the muscle. And the neurotransmitter is released. What is this neurotransmitter? It's going to be, I've never found an exception. There's never an exception to this. Acetylcholine works at every neuromuscular junction, so we would say this is a cholinergic neuron because it releases acetylcholine. Right? That means that it can become a signaling molecule that moves by diffusion from near the presynaptic membrane. From what kind of concentration would acetylcholine be here? Okay, near the presynaptic membrane. It's going to be high. The postsynaptic membrane, the concentration of ACH is low. Can ACH move from high to low all by itself, passively? Indeed it can. That's what we call diffusion, right? So acetylcholine diffuses across the synaptic cleft, and fortunately it can bump into a receptor, and you might be able to recognize these receptors. It has two proteins that span the membrane. Each one of these proteins binds one acetylcholine. And yeah, you should know this is just a nice ligand gated channel, and it's a nicotinic channel. When it binds to acetylcholine, it opens up, and then the predominant effect is sodium entering the cell, right? And that produces an EPSP, right? A graded potential, which is always excitatory, right? Nicotinic channels are always excitatory. All right, so here we have a huge EPSP. And what else do we have within the neuromuscular junction? This is strange. This is the departure from what you've learned in terms of neurons. Look at what's right here, a voltage-gated channel. So as soon as the ligand binds to this nicotinic channel, sodium rushes in, causing depolarization. That will always trigger the opening of this voltage-gated channel, right? And that will start, and that's going to, because threshold has been reached, so an action potential starts right within the neuromuscular junction or even on the periphery, okay? So this synapse in a neuron, where do we have these kinds of synapses between two different neurons? Where do we have ligand-gated channels in a neuron? Dendrites and cell body. Can a dendrite and cell body produce an action potential? No, because it doesn't have voltage-gated channels. But the neuromuscular junction does. So any time an action potential comes down this neuron, right, and binds to these nicotinic channels, what is always the result? The EPSPs are produced. Yeah, EPSPs are produced, and it's always above threshold, so an action potential is always produced. Right, so it doesn't have this neuromuscular junction, or the muscle doesn't have an axon hillock, right, that has to weigh whether or not the threshold has been reached. It is always reached. So what's the end result for this muscle right here? It always contracts when it gets a signal. It cannot make up its mind to do anything else. All right, so we have that action potential running around on the cell membrane. It can also go down into the transverse tubule. Without that transverse tubule, the action potential would be stuck on the edge of the cell, not down into the myofibrils. And as the action potential moves into the T-tubule, it runs into some other things. Like there are voltage-gated channels, so the action potential does propagate through there. All right, and there are also voltage-gated calcium channels that open up. Voltage-gated calcium channels. So if that voltage-gated calcium channel opens up, what happens? Where's calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. So calcium rushes in, right? And calcium then can bind to troponin, get tropomyosin out of the way. These filaments can slide over each other. But there's something that's even more important, right? So here are those voltage-gated calcium channels. They're attached to another receptor that we call ryanodine receptor. And these things are just coupled together, mechanically, physically coupled together, so when the conformation of this voltage-gated channel changes, it opens up this channel right here. And this channel is about 10 times the diameter as the voltage-gated calcium channel. So as we increase the size of the hole in this membrane, more calcium can rush out, right? A huge amount of calcium rushes out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the fluid of this myofibril, and that's really the predominant effect, right, of the signal in this particular myofibril. It's calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, maybe a little bit from the extracellular source, because there are other kind of channels that open up when calcium bind to them. They're called calcium-induced calcium release channels. Okay, so there are a lot of calcium channels that open up, and that gets tropomyosin out of the way so that these myofilaments can slide over each other. All right, so just remember, voltage-gated channels within the neuromuscular junction, ryanodine receptors that couple the electrical activity in the T-tubule to the sarcoplasmic reticulum that allows this calcium just to flood this myofibril because it's at such a high concentration. I got one question for you. What can affect the rate of diffusion that I'm looking at here? What can affect the rate of diffusion? How about concentration gradient? Yeah. What happens if the concentration gradient goes to zero? What about diffusion? It stops. If the concentration gradient gets a little bit bigger, what happens to diffusion? It increases a little bit. If the concentration gradient changes by a lot, what happens to diffusion? It changes a lot, right? So the concentration gradient is directly related to the rate of diffusion. And since the concentration in this smooth endoplasmic reticulum is so high, it's enormous compared to the fluid inside of a myofibril, that's a huge concentration gradient, which means what about diffusion? It's fast, right? Okay. All right, but I did see a question someplace.
So when the P receptor, that is the voltage-gated calcium channel?
Yep. Okay. Yep. And it's connected to this ryanodine receptor. And there are other receptors not drawn on this diagram, like the calcium-induced calcium release channels. It's not a perfect illustration, but it's pretty close. All right, the DHP and the ryanodine are coupled together, and when the DHP changes conformation, it pulls on the ryanodine receptor, and that opens up the channel. Just like if you were to pull on a door and open it up, it works the same way. So we call that electromechanical release of calcium due to that ryanodine receptor. All right, so a little bit of calcium enters from the extracellular source. Most of it comes from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so here is the whole excitation-contraction coupling mechanism, starting with release of acetylcholine within the neuromuscular junction, right? And that's going to cause release of calcium. Calcium is going to bind to troponin, right? And that's going to get tropomyosin out of the way. So you can look at all of these steps right here. I don't know if this is an exam figure, but this probably would be pretty good to understand. Okay. Yeah.
On the table.
Okay.
So that's the thing has to happen first before the muscle contraction.
Yeah, calcium has to bind to troponin. Troponin changes shape. That pulls tropomyosin out of the way, right? It reveals the myosin binding sites on actin. Okay. All right, so what did I had a thought right here. Muscle relaxation. Let's go back to this slide. There is another protein in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum that is working all the time, and it requires ATP. It's taking calcium, low concentration within the myofibril, and putting it back, high concentration inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. It requires ATP. What do we call that process? Or what do we call a protein that would be able to do that? What do you call a protein that can take sodium that's inside the cell and kick it outside? At the same time, it can take a potassium that's on the outside and put it on the inside. Yeah, the sodium potassium pump. What kind of pump is that? It's an ATP. Yeah, it's a sodium potassium ATP pump, right? So if it uses ATP, we consider it a pump. And it's primary active transport. That's the kind of protein we don't see in this endoplasmic reticulum right here. but it is there and it is working all the time, moving calcium inside the cell. When there's no action potential, the primary effect of calcium is that it's going to be pumped into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But if there is an action potential, those pumps still work, but they can't keep up with the amount of calcium that's leaving because of those calcium-induced release channels and the ryanodine receptors are opening up. Right? But those pumps are working all the time. So when the action potential disappears and all of those calcium channels that were opened up by that action potential close, now what happens? The pumps are working, and now the predominant effect is calcium moving from the myofibril back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when that happens, then the sliding filament mechanism can't happen, and so the muscle relaxes, right? So that was this slide right here. Muscle relaxation is due to those calcium pumps reducing calcium concentration within the myofibril, and hence troponin doesn't bind calcium, tropomyosin gets back in the way of the cross bridge formation, and since cross bridges can't form, the muscle relaxes as a result. Right, because those calcium pumps are working all the time. They can't keep up when there's an action potential there, but when that action potential goes away, then they can have a predominant effect. All right, characteristics of contractions. Probably you went over some of this in lab. All right? Yeah, question. Yeah.
No calcium release and muscle no
injection. Yeah. If there's no action potential in this P-tubule, these calcium channels close, but there's something always working in the background. It doesn't matter if there's action potential there or not. Right? The calcium channels close when there's no action potential, but what is working all the time? The calcium pumps. So no action potential, so calcium doesn't leave, the pumps are pumping it back in, so the predominant effect is what? Storing calcium back into the endoplasmic reticulum. When that happens, then the muscle starts to relax because calcium goes down. Okay. So here we have something that could be a little bit confusing because the axes of this graph are not labeled. Right? But when I see these spikes right here, it kind of reminds me of an action potential. Do you kind of see an action potential here a little bit? Right. If there was an action potential, we would label this graph as what? Voltage versus time? Okay? But that's not what we have. What we have is something versus time, but it is tension. Okay? It's tension versus time. It has nothing to do with the electrical properties. Right? I mean, well, it does, but it's not shown on this graph. It's just tension. When a muscle fiber starts to contract, it produces tension. All right, and we can shock a muscle to contract. We can stimulate a muscle to contract with a little electrical current, and the muscle is going to contract, and it's going to produce a certain amount of tension. All right, and so this is what we call a twitch. Maybe just think of one muscle fiber, one cell. We can cause it to contract, and it's going to produce a certain amount of tension, and then it's going to start to relax. What's happening during this relaxation? Okay. Yeah, but let's not think in terms of electrical activity. Let's think about that excitation contraction mechanism. What has to happen when this muscle is relaxing? Yeah, calcium is being pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Okay. Well, here I see something interesting. If we come along before all the calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum and shock that muscle fiber once again, guess what it's going to do? It's going to contract again, but since there was a little residual calcium in the myofibril, now the second twitch produces more tension. So if these two twitches right here are not the same, can that be an action potential? No, because action potentials are always the same, right? They cannot summate. But in this particular case, I see these muscle twitches summating, right? The second one produces more tension than the first because there's still some leftover calcium. It hasn't all been pumped away by the time the second twitch came along. Okay, and remember, every muscle fiber contracts to its maximum every time that it receives a stimulus. All right. So if we continue stimulating this muscle at faster and faster repetitions, right, then this is the kind of graph that we would get. So again, this is not voltage versus time. We're looking at tension versus time. All right, and can you see that at this time we gave a shock to a muscle and before it relaxed, right, especially not to this level here, if it just relaxed a little bit, We shocked it again, then the muscle would contract, produce a little bit more tension because there's a lot of residual calcium left in the myofibril. And before this twitch relaxes, we shock it again. It produces more. So we see summation taking place. Right? And then after a certain period of time, then it's going to plateau, right? Because there's not a large concentration gradient anymore, or maybe all the tropomyosin molecules, most of them are bound already with calcium. We call that saturation. Remember when all the binding sites are taken, even if you increase substrate concentration or calcium, it's got no place to bind, so it can't produce a greater effect. Right, so we call this a plateau. This is what we call incomplete tetanus because the muscle fiber actually starts to relax between these stimulations. And then over here, right, if we double the number of shocks per second, right, it's not just a nice, smooth, solid line. I still see some relaxation taking place. Right, but it does smooth this line out a little bit. That is still incomplete tetanus. Right, but if we increase the number of shocks, right, to 60, right, we increase it 6 times, look what happens to this plateau phase. Okay, there's no relaxation whatsoever. The muscle is just contracted. Right, and so we call this complete tetanus. And complete tetanus, so when that muscle is contracted, what happens to the biochemistry inside that muscle cell? What happens to it? Can you think of, like, respiration? What are the two kinds of respiration that make ATP? Yeah, aerobic and anaerobic. When a muscle contracts, what kind of respiration is taking place? Anaerobic, because blood can't even get into that muscle because it's a big solid mass, right? And so anaerobic respiration takes over, and that anaerobic respiration produces lactic acid, changes the pH of that muscle fiber, right? And so when the pH starts to change, then this is the muscle starts to lose the ability to contract. We call that fatigue. And that would be what we call physiologic fatigue because of buildup of acids, depletion of ATP, other things that are taking place inside the muscle. Okay, then the force generated is going to decrease. There's also something called psychological fatigue. You move a muscle use a muscle very strenuously. What is that going to feel like? Like if it goes into a solid contraction it's a cramp. Spasm. Spasm was what I was trying to think. Yeah, spasm and cramp are the same thing. So if you get a spasm or cramp in one of your muscles, okay, how does that feel? Are you really proud of that muscle? You're going to show that muscle off to everybody because big bulging out of there. Okay. Well, probably y'all know it hurts like hell. Right? Okay. You'll do anything to get that muscle spasm to go away. You'll work the other arm, relax, do whatever you can do, right, to get that muscle spasm to go away. And I forget the point that I was trying to make with that muscle spasm. Other than, psychological fatigue. Whenever you use a muscle, it produces pain. That's psychological fatigue. That's different than physiologic that I see in this particular example right here. And trained athletes don't pay any attention whatsoever to psychological fatigue. They work right through it. Okay. I don't know why this slide is right in here because we talked about that one already. Here is something that's hugely important. The length-tension relationship for skeletal muscle, and this is going to be important for cardiac muscle as well. What does cardiac muscle make? Your heart. Is your heart an important organ? Yeah, so we want to know a lot about this length-tension relationship because we want to know, right, how the heart produces tension, how it pumps blood. It's got to produce tension in order to pump blood, and it's related to the length of a muscle. All right, so the strength of muscle contraction is influenced by a couple things. First, it's the frequency of stimulation, right? If we stimulate a muscle, right, then we get summation, and it can get stronger and stronger. The thickness of each muscle fiber. So as a muscle cell gets thicker in diameter, what else increases inside that cell? The number of myofibrils, right? And the myofibril is the organelle of contraction. So as the number of myofibrils increases, then that muscle fiber can produce more tension because there's more contractile elements in there, right? And then here's something that's not intuitive at all. These others you can kind of see and figure out. It's the initial length of a muscle fiber determines what kind of tension it can produce. And you have the understanding of it because you know the structure of a sarcomere. And in order for filaments to slide over each other, what has to be the relationship between these filaments? Can they be separated by a mile? No, then they're not going to slide. What can you tell me about the spatial relationship of these filaments before they can slide over each other? Yeah, they have to overlap each other a little bit, right? So that overlap of actin and myosin is going to determine how much tension that sarcomere can produce, right? There is an ideal resting length that generates the maximum force, right? If a sarcomere is stretched out completely, no contraction because there's no overlap, right? And if the sarcomere is contracted completely, what about tension that it can produce? None, because the myosin is bumping up against the Z-disc, right? So there's some area in between that can generate force. Well, I don't know where any of these slides are coming from. Okay, so let's look at this plot right here. We have a plot of tension, okay, versus the length of a muscle from at rest. This 100% right here just means what the length of this muscle will be when it's neither contracting or stretched, when it is completely relaxed. All right, so notice that when the muscle is completely relaxed, it can produce a lot of tension, right? And if we stretch the muscle a little bit more, we stretch at 20%, right? Can you see there is an increase in the tension that is produced, right? And then if we stretch it some more, all the way, maybe not quite to 200%, not double its length, but what happens to tension when we overstretch the muscle? Mm-hmm. You see that it's going down, right? If we go the other way, right, if we don't stretch the sarcomere door, if it starts to shorten already before it contracts, what happens to tension? It decreases as well. So here is this plateau region. So here is the ascending limb. Here is the descending limb for this length tension relationship. Let's relate it to the structure of this sarcomere. All right, so over here, we've overstretched the sarcomere. What can you tell me about the overlap between actin and myosin? There's none. Can any cross bridges form? Absolutely not. No tension can be produced. All right, so let's bring the sarcomere shorter, bring the Z-disc closer together. Do you see any overlap between actin and myosin? Indeed, I do, right? And right here, it looks as if most of the myosin head groups have the ability to attach to this actin molecule, right? There's almost perfect overlap. But if this muscle starts to contract with the sarcomere much shorter, like over here, the sarcomere is short, so that the length of the sarcomere is the exact length of this myosin, right? Can this sarcomere contract anymore? It cannot. It cannot produce any tension. All right, so we can relate this, okay, to the graph. All right, so here, since the muscle can't produce any more tension, we see this limb of the length tension relationship. It can't contract because the initial resting length was too short. When we have more optimal overlap, the tension that's produced by the sarcomere increases, and then as we pull the sarcomere apart, we pull these filaments too far apart from each other, then the tension decreases once again. So the amount of tension that a muscle can produce is related to the amount of stretch that is applied to it before it contracts. And as you see, here is the normal resting length, and that's why one of the things that athletes do is, before they demand a lot of their muscles, is to stretch them out, and they get a little bit better, more optimal overlap of these actin and myosin myofilaments. Okay, and some other good things happen as well. Okay, so that's what we call the length-tension relationship when we get to the next chapter. That's going to be really important as well. Neural control of skeletal muscle. Well, there is one somatic motor neuron that moves from the spinal cord all the way to skeletal muscle. There's only one neuron that's required to do that. Remember, for the autonomic nervous system, it was two. All right, but many other neurons can synapse on that one somatic motor neuron. The somatic motor neuron, sometimes we call the lower motor neuron, that's a final common pathway where a lot of other neurons, right, will influence what that motor neuron is going to do. Right, so other activity can influence the excitatory impulses going to a skeletal muscle. And in order for anything to maintain homeostasis, what is a good way that any kind of system can maintain homeostasis? I like feedback. Negative feedback is really good, right? So feedback. There has to be some kind of feedback. So in order for a skeletal muscle to contract to the proper tension or length, right, then some place in your body has to know what that muscle is doing. And it's got to share that information with your central nervous system, right, in order to form a nice response loop. Okay, so skeletal muscle must have continuous sensory feedback. And the two things that it receives is length information. Sometimes we could call that stretch. It needs stretch information, and it also needs tension information. And so in order to measure length or tension, what do you need? In order to measure light, what do you need? What do you need to appreciate some kind of stimulus? Yeah, receptors, right? So there are stretch receptors in muscles, and there are tension receptors, right? These are two different things. The tension receptors are in tendons. We call these Golgi tendon organs. The receptors in muscle are what we call muscle spindle apparatus. And I'm not going to go into too much detail. I'll show you what they're really good for. All right, so here's a skeletal muscle, and I see a muscle spindle. The muscle spindle measures stretch, and I would probably have to make a video and put it in Blackboard for you to really appreciate what's going on right here, because it maybe might take me a while to do that. But we have muscle fibers, which are cells. These are the muscles that we call the extrafusal fibers. These are the normal fibers in a muscle that contract, that produce tension. Then we have some muscle fibers within the spindle apparatus. They can contract, but they really don't produce any tension. Right? They can just match the contraction that's happening in these extrafusal fibers. And when the length of the spindle matches the length of these extrafusal fibers, right, if they're exactly the same length, then there is no error that's monitored between these two fibers. But if the muscle spindle is told to go to a certain length, and then all of a sudden something happens to where the skeletal muscle starts to stretch, then there's a difference in length between the spindle apparatus and these fibers right here that cause contraction. And if there's a difference, then it sends that information back via these sensory neurons so that your body can make an adjustment, right? It can prevent further stretch. So the muscle spindle apparatus is important for looking at stretch, and it's used, right, for what we call, okay, the stretch reflex. And it's a monosynaptic reflex. It only requires two neurons. One from the muscle spindle apparatus. Right, so here is one from the muscle spindle apparatus. How do you know this is a nice sensory neuron? Because it's going in the dorsal root, right? Here's nice dorsal root ganglia. It's always going to be a sensory neuron that gets information from the spindle apparatus. If the spindle apparatus is the same length as the muscle itself, that looks like a nice rectus femoris right here. If they're the same length, is there an error? No. And so then no information, so then the central nervous system doesn't have to come up with a decision to change, right, the length of this quadriceps muscle, because it's at the proper length. But what happens if all of a sudden something stretches the quadriceps? It stretches it, so then it pulls on the spindle apparatus, right? They're not the same length anymore. That sends an error signal into the spinal cord. And that sensory neuron synapses directly on a somatic motor neuron that sends action potentials to the skeletal muscle to a neuromuscular junction. And what's always going to be the effect when this somatic motor neuron sends an action potential to a neuromuscular junction? It's going to have that muscle contract. Okay. So what was the initial stimulus? Was stretch. And what's the response? The opposite of stretch, which is contraction. So what can you tell me about the stimulus and the response? Do they add together or do they subtract? They subtract. What kind of feedback is that? Nice negative feedback mechanism. So that is tested all the time with this knee-jerk reflex. Right? So what do we got? Rectus femoris, right? A nice tendon of the quadriceps, patella, and then here we have the patellar ligament. So if you sit down in a chair and flex at the knee, somebody can come along with an object and slam that into the patellar ligament right here. That's going to pull on the patella, right? That's going to pull on the tendon. That's going to pull on the muscle. It's going to stretch the muscle. But you got these spindle apparati in there saying, hey, I didn't tell this muscle to stretch, and it's stretching. You might fall over or something. This muscle is behaving inappropriately. That information is sent to the central nervous system, right? So the receptor is the spindle apparatus, and then this motor neuron is going to tell this rectus femoris to contract, right? And so the response is going to subtract from the initial stimulus. All right, so monosynaptic stretch reflex is due to spindle apparatus, and it just maintains proper muscle tone in your body. The other kind of reflex, Golgi tendon organ reflex, where do we find Golgi tendon organs? In tendons, right? They work a little bit differently, right? So they don't look at the length of a muscle or the tension in the muscle, right? They just measure the force that's produced by this particular muscle, right? And the Golgi tendon organ responds to increasing tension. As the tension increases, like we lift up a really heavy weight that produces a lot of tension on this tendon, it's going to send information to the central nervous system. Now here we have an interneuron, right? The interneuron is going to be excited by the Golgi tendon organ, but this is an inhibitory association neuron, so it's going to inhibit, right, this somatic motor neuron, and when this is inhibited, you get less action potentials to the muscle. What's going to happen to the muscles if you decrease action potentials to it? Yeah, it's going to relax. All right, so the stretch causes contraction. The Golgi organ is going to cause relaxation. When would be a good idea to have this Golgi tendon reflex right here? Well, maybe you're helping your friend move a refrigerator, washing machine from one place to another, right? So you got this big refrigerator. And what can you tell me about a refrigerator if you got to hold half of it up?
Heavy.
It's heavy, right. Just barely you can hold it up. And then all of a sudden something happens to your friend and he drops, he lets go of his end of the refrigerator. So now what are you holding up? The whole refrigerator, okay? And if you're going to hold up the whole refrigerator, it's going to rip these muscles. It could pull these tendons off of bones, all right? But fortunately, that won't happen. Unconsciously, you will let go of it as well, because why? These Golgi tendon organs are saying, hey, you've lost your mind. You're lifting way too much weight. We're going to prevent damage from this muscle. So that sends that tension information into the spinal cord, this inhibitory association neuron, then is going to decrease the number of axons to this muscle, I mean action potentials to this muscle. It's going to relax, and you're going to drop that heavy weight. And when you do, what happens to this tendon and muscle?
They relax,
and the ultimate effect is what? Are they damaged?
No,
that preserves these particular structures, right? So the Golgi tendon is for inhibition. The stretch reflex is more of an excitation. So that's it for cardiac muscle. Got to talk a little bit, skeletal muscle. So we got to talk a little bit about cardiac and smooth. All right, so let's just think. Can you think in your mind, what are some similarities of cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle? Do you ever recognize any similarities? Okay. I see striations if I look really hard in cardiac muscle. Easy to see in skeletal muscle. So both have striations, which means that the internal machinery for contraction is the same in cardiac and skeletal. What is that little machine, the structural and functional unit of contraction called? Sarcomere. So cardiac muscle has sarcomeres because it's striated. And you know all the structures of a sarcomere, so we don't have to go over that again. All right, smooth muscle is not striated, so it has a totally different kind of mechanism for contraction. Let's talk about cardiac muscle first. All right, and how do you know this is cardiac muscle? Because it is branched, right? And if it was skeletal muscle, it would not be branched. Skeletal muscle is also long. But what about this cardiac muscle cell? It is short, okay? And so if these cardiac muscles were to contract, the ones that are next to each other would pull apart from each other, and then you would have a hole in what organ? Your heart. Not something that anybody would want, right? So these junctions between cardiac muscle cells are what we call intercalated discs. They have special kind of junctions, adherence junctions, so that they cannot pull apart from each other, but they also have another important junction that we call a gap junction. And a gap junction, remember, is just a channel, and in particular a sodium channel. So that's really important for the heart. For instance, if this top cardiac muscle cell depolarizes, right, what happens to the cell next to it? It will depolarize as well, because sodium will rush into the cell on the left. Now we have high sodium on the left, low on the right. It will diffuse into the right, right, and that's going to depolarize the cell on the right. So, right, this whole layer is going to depolarize within the heart. But don't forget, these cells are branched. So if this cell depolarizes, what happens to the layer underneath it? It depolarizes as well. What about the layer underneath it? It depolarizes. So not only does this heart depolarize from right to left, but also throughout the whole wall thickness. This means that the heart, if one cell contracts, right, they all contract. And that's really important for the heart, because the heart, in order to pump blood, has to contract as a unit. One part of it can't contract while the other part relaxes, because blood will go into the relaxed part of the heart and not to your body. Right, so the heart has to contract completely. And it does that through these kinds of synapses. Anybody remember what kind of synapse we call this gap junction? Okay. It's an intercalated disc. All right. But what kind of synapse? Synapse is what? The structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Neuromuscular junction is what kind of synapse? A chemical synapse. Right? Because it uses a chemical, right? It uses a neurotransmitter, acetylcholine. But here is what kind of synapse? It doesn't use neurotransmitter. It uses electrical signals, right? Like the movement of sodium. So this is what? An electrical synapse. A little bit different than a chemical synapse. All right. So let's zoom in to the cell membrane. Can you recognize this to be the cell membrane right here? Or some kind of membrane, because it's what? A phospholipid bilayer. And that's the one way to think of the membrane. What's a better way to think of a membrane? Fluid mosaic model. So the cell can also insert other kinds of structures into the cell membrane, like proteins, channels, for instance. Okay, so here we have the cell membrane on a cardiac muscle cell. And here are the sodium channels. These are voltage-gated sodium channels. So what can propagate on the surface of a cardiac muscle cell? Because it has voltage-gated sodium channels. Yeah, action potential, right? So an action potential can flow over the surface of the heart, right, or the surface of these cells. And here is a transverse tubule. The transverse tubule not only has voltage-gated channels for sodium, but also for calcium. Right? So when these are triggered, when an action potential comes by, what happens to calcium? It enters the cell because it's high outside, right? That calcium then can bind to a molecule. What is it? What does calcium bind to inside the cell? Okay. If it was smooth muscle, it would be calmodulin. If it is skeletal muscle, it is troponin. And if it's cardiac muscle, it is troponin. Because remember, the sarcomeres are almost the same in cardiac and skeletal muscle. So calcium binds to troponin, right, and then the sarcomere can shorten because these filaments will slide over each other. All right. Well, as calcium enters the cell, there are some other channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And just like in skeletal muscle, there is a high concentration of calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And here's that calcium ATP pump that's always pumping calcium into, right, so there's high concentration. But when calcium starts to enter from the extracellular side, or extracellular source, it's almost like a ligand-gated channel. When there's high calcium, this thing opens, and this is huge. So when this channel opens, it's called a calcium-induced calcium release channel. What's going to be released when this thing opens up? Calcium. And what induces it to open up? Calcium signal from outside the cell. Right? So calcium comes in through these voltage-gated calcium channels. It causes these calcium-induced calcium release channels to open up. So now what happens to the concentration of calcium, all right, around these filaments inside the heart? It goes way up, right? Binds to troponin. These filaments will slide over each other. That causes muscle contraction. When that action potential goes away, right, then these calcium channels close. These calcium-induced calcium release channels close. And then what's the predominant effect? Yeah, Relaxation because the calcium ATP pump is always pumping calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The calcium can no longer bind to troponin, and the heart relaxes. Okay, so for skeletal muscle, the calcium comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum. For cardiac muscle, the calcium pore contraction comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum and the extracellular source. Almost an equal balance of the two. Yeah. It's a balance. Yeah, like in skeletal muscle. For skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, it's both. For skeletal muscle, it's primarily sarcoplasmic reticulum. And a little bit from the extracellular source. Yeah. It might depend on the state of the muscle, too, a little bit. But for cardiac muscle, it's almost equal. It's almost equal. Okay? Okay. And nonetheless, they still have sarcomeres. All right. Smooth muscle, a little bit different. All right. Smooth muscle still has myosin. It still has actin. They can slide over each other, but I don't see a sarcomere. What I see right here is a network on the surface of the cell. And these things are what we call dense bodies. So actin is attached to a dense body, not a Z disc. And you have myosin in the middle. When myosin and actin slide over each other, what happens to these dense bodies? Do they get farther apart or closer together? They get closer together. So the whole muscle cell kind of just puckers down from the surface. Right? So the whole muscle cell gets shorter, not quite as nifty as a skeletal muscle or cardiac muscle fiber, right? But it still shortens because of actin and myosin. The myosin is a little bit different, has a little bit different arrangement. It does have an ATPase, but it's relatively slow. So smooth muscle contracts much more slowly compared to cardiac and skeletal muscle because the enzymes are just smaller. All right. This slide right here describes what's happening on this slide. This is an exam figure. Let's go over this figure. Oh, we don't have time, do we? Time is up. Look at this figure, or maybe I'll make a video of this thing so I don't have to go over it next time or go over it very quickly. Okay. One, I guess one last thing. For skeletal muscle, no, for smooth muscle, calcium comes from the extracellular source. Very little from sarcoplasmic reticulum. So you kind of go from one end of the continuum to the other. Skeletal, primarily sarcoplasmic reticulum. Smooth, mostly extracellular source. All right, that's the last thing. Sign-in sheet is going around. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And I'll see you Wednesday. Is there a test Wednesday? There is not. Thursday. Well, there's not a test on Wednesday or Thursday, right? It's next week. Very limited.